the really fun thing is being able to help with that and being able to do, well, what I always dreamed of, right, as a kid, which I'm going to take the stress off of owners and make sure they can live the life they dreamed of with their dog.
Welcome to the Believe in Dog podcast. I'm your host, Erin Scott, and I've been a dog mom for over 20 years. On this podcast, we are going to celebrate the amazing parts of being a pet parent. We're going to navigate the challenges together and learn everything that dog moms and dog dads should know. I believe that dogs can show up in our lives as healers, as teachers, and as inspirations. And I can't wait to get started. This is Believe in Dog. Welcome to episode 90 of the Believe in Dog podcast. I'm your host, Erin Scott, and thank you so much for being here today. You know, my schedule has been a little wonky, so I thank you for your patience between being sick for like 10 days and barely having a voice a couple days. And then I went to this really amazing 3-day training seminar with Suzanne Clothier, and that has just completely all thrown my schedule off. But at least the training seminar was worth it, even if the being sick part wasn't. If you aren't familiar with Suzanne Clothier, I'll put a link in the show notes so that you can look her up. She is probably my favorite dog trainer. She wrote a book called Bones Would Rain from the Sky, and it is probably the book that affected my life as a dog mom more than anything else. And she has built a whole concept around relationship-centered dog training, and I just love this so much. And of course, you know, I got this new crazy dog, Nessie, here at the house, and she is a lovely, sweet, amazing girl, but she's definitely a dog that's going to make me step up my game in the training world, let me tell you. Have you ever seen those memes online that say, I got a dog to help me with my anxiety, but now my dog has anxiety? And while I know that these are kind of funny and meant to get a laugh out of people, the issue of dog anxiety is something that's very close to my own heart, and is also something that has been a big problem for many people who I know. And so we're going to talk today to Alex Peacock, a dog trainer who has kind of found a niche specializing in helping anxious dogs. And if you're somebody who has dealt with dog anxiety, you might want to have a notebook by your side while listening to this. Alex drops so many gems, so much great information. So we're going to hear more about Alex, but first, a quick word from one of our sponsors. Even though February was Pet Dental Health Month, we really need to care about our dogs' dental health all year long. I recently learned that 80% of our dogs over 3 years old have active dental or periodontal disease. And dental disease is actually a sign of other inflammation in the body and can be connected to everything from cardiovascular problems, kidney problems, diabetes, certain types of cancers, joint disease. Your dog's dental health actually can affect everything in their body. And you know that I am obsessed with finding the best and healthiest products for our dogs. So I was so excited to find out about Teef. That's right, Teef. Just a tiny spoonful of Teef powder in your dog's water bowl will make a huge improvement in your dog's dental health. It's the only thing that ever made my vet stop and go, hey, what did you do with Penny's teeth? They actually look so much better. So forget trying to figure out how to get your dog's teeth brushed without them biting you. Forget those sticks or green chews. What you need is Teef powder, just a tiny amount in your dog's water bowl. And listeners of this podcast can save 20% on your Teef order with the code ADM. And you'll be on your way to a healthier smile for your dog without any anesthesia needed. Check out the link in the show notes to find out more about Teef and save 20% on your orders. This code will work on their cat product too. One of the questions I had for Alex is, are we making our dog's anxiety worse? And if so, what is it that we're doing that is causing this problem? Have you ever wondered this too? So I think you'll really appreciate Alex's insight when he answers this question. Something else that was a little bit of a mic drop moment for me when chatting with Alex was around the idea of how many times it's not so much that the dog has anxiety, but that we have chosen the wrong dog for our lifestyle. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this phenomenon, but I've seen people who get a working breed dog and then want them to hang out in the basement all day while they're at work. And that's not a good fit for that dog's lifestyle. They're going to become destructive. They're going to have a lot of pent up energy. You know, these dogs that are just like vibrating sometimes when you see them because they just have so much pent up energy and don't have a proper outlet for it. So Alex gives some interesting numbers around how many times he sees families who choose the wrong dog for their lifestyle. And I don't know the answer to fixing that problem, but it was really interesting to hear a trainer's perspective on this, given how many dogs and how many families that he works with. And Alex is going to give us some insight into his program for working with families with anxious dogs. He has this incredibly comprehensive program that he has these three pillars that he works with. He's going to describe all of this, describe his process. And I think it's one of the most, you know, incredibly comprehensive programs that I've heard about. And I also wanted to, I don't know if trigger warning is the right word, but Alex is going to tell us about how he was inspired to become a dog trainer, and it has to do with a TV show that aired in the early 2000s. And this TV show, as you know, The Dog Whisperer, Cesar Millan, became quite controversial because of the methods that Cesar Millan used. And I got to tell you, it was really disappointing for me to see some of the stuff that came out about Cesar Millan, because being the time period that this was, I think the show started back in 2004, Tim and I had just adopted our first dog, and you know, pit bulls were still a little bit funky and controversial back then. And I feel like we've come a long way over the past 20 years. But it was a big deal to us to be able to see Cesar Millan. If you remember, he had his pit bull named Daddy, and then Junior. And to see a dog, you know, being so positive in this way meant a lot to us back at that time. So it was really disappointing to sort of see how all of that played out. And Alex admits, like, even though he was a kid, which by the way makes me feel really old, when he first started watching Cesar Millan, he doesn't do anything like that in his methodology and how he works with dogs or anything. But that was where his inspiration came from, because it was really exciting for him to see that as a kid and to realize that, you know, maybe he could help the family dogs that he had, you know, develop better behavior. So we are going to dive into the Cesar Millan thing a little bit. And I guess I felt like I wanted to prepare you for that in case that's something that would be upsetting for you. But please be advised that Alex does not do any kind of training methods and does not condone that. We were just talking about what it was like 20 years ago to see this show on television for the first time. So let's get started. I'm really excited for you to meet Alex Peacock. So we are here today with Alex Peacock. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Erin?
I'm great. Thanks so much for being here today. You know, I always love starting off my interviews by asking about your childhood experiences with pets. If people have listened to the podcast before, they probably know that I did not grow up with any animals. I didn't even know that I liked dogs until I was 25. I was kind of a reluctant dog owner, believe it or not, but it has changed my whole life. And so I'm always curious what that looks like for everybody else. So what was your experience?
Yeah, I had a very unique upbringing with pets. My first pet was a snake. Well, I think my first pet was a hamster, but I barely remember that one. My first pet that I really was excited about was a snake, and that was when I was 8 years old. And then, and it took me about 3 years to convince my parents to get me a snake. And they finally did. I was super excited. I was pretty content for about 2 years. And then I thought, I could get another snake. And that opened up a whole new can of worms where they were like, we thought you wanted one, now you want two. Why aren't you just happy with one? But I had kind of I had the bug to collect, you know, various animals. I just thought they were the coolest thing. And so I convinced them to let me get a second snake, and that just opened the floodgates. And by the time I was probably 15 or 16, my brother and I had, my wife and I met when we were 16, and she says that my bedroom looked like a pet store. She said it wasn't a bedroom. It was a pet store with two beds in it. Because of course I would show off all my animals whenever somebody came over to the house. And luckily she loves all the creepy crawlies too. So she was just really impressed and not grossed out by the fact that I had all these animals in my bedroom. So by the time I was probably 16, my brother and I counted one day, we had, I think, 40 different exotic animals in our bedroom.
Oh my God.
That was kind of my life, was just, I just did that, they all were cared for because that was what we did. You know what I mean? It's like, sounds like a hoarding situation, but it was really just my obsession. And so we got into that for a long time. And then when I was probably about 14, I think it was, I was watching Mythbusters at the time, because I always liked watching informational type, interesting shows. And I ran out of, I ran out of Mythbusters episodes to watch that were available on Netflix or what it was. But I ran out of episodes of that to watch. And I told my mom, I was like, yeah, I kind of want to watch something else, but I don't know what to watch. And she just, for whatever reason, said, well, have you heard of The Dog Whisperer? And I was like, no. And she was like, oh, it's this guy, people think it's cool. He trains dogs. And whatever whatever your opinion is of The Dog Whisperer, I knew nothing about dog training at the time. So all I knew was I turned on this show and I had the family dog sitting next to me when I watched the first episode. And I remember watching that episode, watching the transformations of these dogs and, all I knew was just this dogs were what I realized in that moment was dogs were so much cooler than I thought. That was my realization. I remember looking over at our quote unquote, dumb lab, right? The one that was always getting himself in trouble. I remember just looking at him and going, I had no idea what was going on in your head. I was like, you are so much more interesting than I thought. I'd always just kind of thought that dogs were just kind of the dumb family pet, the one you just pat the head of on the way out the door. And from that moment on, I thought, well, I want to learn how to do, what I saw on TV. I was like, I got to learn how to do that. I want to learn how to communicate with dogs. And so I thought, well, I might as well train the family dog. We had a chocolate lab at the time and he caused a lot of problems. My family didn't really know what they were doing with dogs and it was kind of my dad's dog. But he was at work, so he couldn't really do a lot of the care. So then it fell on the rest of us. And that was kind of frustrating for my mom. And so it was kind of like a tense topic, the dog, and we always tended to get the dogs that were really high energy, like a lot of people do. We didn't get the right dog for us. We would get the dogs that were really high energy, get the dogs that were particularly difficult dogs. And so we had this, this chocolate lab. And of course, in my mind, the TV dog trainers made it look so easy. I thought, well, I'm just going to figure out how to do this. And I loved learning. I was homeschooled growing up. I loved learning how to do any project I had. I just did it. My parents were really great about supporting us in projects. So I thought, oh yeah, this is my next project. I'll learn how to train the family dog. Easy peasy. And boy, did I have another thing coming. I tried really hard and I felt like I just fell on my face. I failed miserably. I couldn't. I mean, my family says I was more successful than I thought I was. I got the dog to do a lot of the things that we needed, but it was so confusing to me. It was so frustrating. And I was very hard-headed about thinking that the methods I was seeing were the exact right methods for my specific dog. And it was always, I'm doing the right thing. Why aren't you listening? Basically was my mindset back then. And I tried for years with various dogs to train the dog. And I felt like it kept flopping. And we had several different dogs with a variety of behavioral issues. And I just was so overwhelmed. But in all honesty, that was the best thing for my dog training journey because it made me determined. I don't know if I would have become a dog trainer if that hadn't happened. It made me so determined. I said, I am going to figure this out. When I'm an adult, I have my own, my own place, my own dog. I have a little more, I can actually, go get, training on how to do these things. I was like, I'm going to learn how to do this. I'm going to figure this out and I'm going to make this happen. And I'm going to make sure that people like me and my family don't have to go through all this stress. And so that's what I did. And my marketing, this guy that I work with marketing, he was cracking up the other day. He was like, so you chose something you were terrible at and made it your job. And I was like, yes, exactly. That's, I guess, kind of my personality is I get annoyed when I can't figure something out. And so I was determined. So that's kind of my fairly long background on pets and how I grew up. And so, yeah, here I am a number of years later, and that's what I do for a living. I've cracked the code, so to speak. I'm always learning, but I think I've got a pretty good handle on it.
Well, I think that that's a really interesting and unique story. And it also, by the way, makes me feel very old because I actually went and looked up when The Dog Whisperer was on TV, and it was from 2004 to 2012. And so 2004 was the year that we bought our house and that we got our first dog. So I was already 25 then. And I'm like, oh, and this kid's just like watching it on TV as a kid. Like, I'm very old.
I don't know if this will make it better or worse, but I was actually getting it on Netflix DVDs in the
Netflix DVDs. Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was back when Netflix was. I don't know if they did streaming at that point. I think
it wasn't streaming.
I think it was just the DVDs.
You sent them back in the mail.
Rentals. Yeah. And so that's one of my biggest memories of dog training as a kid was I would finish the DVDs in like a day, right? I would watch, 15 like episodes in like a day or two. And then I would like agonizing, wait a week to get my next, Cesar Millan DVDs in the mail. And like I said, I have a very tender place in my heart for Cesar Millan. I don't agree with everything. And I don't like to get into the politics of it because I just think it's like kind of a waste of time. And if you watched my training, you would not probably think that you wouldn't be like, oh yeah, he trains like Cesar Millan.
Right.
But I think he's very near and dear to my heart because that was who inspired me. In all honesty, that was who inspired me to become a dog trainer. And I think the art of dog training is always evolving. And so, I may not do things like he did, but I always appreciate the fact that he gave me the drive to decide to learn how to do this.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think for sure it was the first time that I ever saw anybody training a dog on television. Yeah. And, like I said, when that show came on TV, it coincided with the year that we got our first dog. And so, my husband and I were talking about this and, we actually did learn valuable things from that show. And it's a shame that, he became such a like polarizing lightning rod kind of figure because like the calm, assertive way of, being with dogs, like that was really helpful for my husband because he's like really kind of an emotionally intense guy. And if something's not, if they're not doing what he thinks they should do, that was a big lesson to him about, just be calm and not reactive. And, and just the whole thing with like exercise and, structure and stuff before, affection, like even that was like helpful. So,
absolutely.
It's a shame kind of how some of the things have played out because there was some value in it. Even for us, 20 years later, we can look back and say that was helpful to us,
100%. What I've kind of come to usually my overall brief description of what I think, if I were to recommend what you take away from the Dog Whisperer is I think the broad lessons were all pretty solid. The be calm and confident, right? Exercise is essential. Setting up rules and boundaries is essential. A lot of his basic and foundational principles were fantastic. I think the biggest problem comes when people try to, and this is with any profession, right? When you try to mimic what he does to fix extreme behaviors yourself without any proper training, right? Cesar Millan has particular methods. And to be honest, in many ways worked very well for him.
For him.
for him, right? But I think when you try to go, I think the hard thing, and this is one of the reasons I don't necessarily use his exact methods is because his methods work pretty darn well if you are an absolute master at those methods, which he was, right? His particular way of training dogs, he was really good at it. I mean, you can't tell me someone who can walk 25 dogs off leash, through a trail in the woods, you can't tell me they don't at least have some, talent for working with dogs, right? Someone who can have a huge pack of dogs and have them work well together. I mean, the man would rollerblade with 10 dogs.
Yeah.
I'll rollerblade with three. barely.
I won't rollerblade anywhere.
So to me it's like, I think that if you use his types of methods, you have to be really, really, really good at them. And I think the other hard thing too is everybody makes mistakes. I'm not condoning particular things. Like I said, I don't like to get out there and like condone particular things that any trainer does. I think you have to take everything take everything as it is. So I'm not broadly condoning or supporting or condemning any particular thing that any trainer does. But I think the other hard thing is when you're so popular, it's like all of your mistakes are going to get broadcast really big. And I'm sure there's things that he looks back on as like, why? Oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. There's things I look back on. I watch old videos of myself training. I'm like, oh my gosh, turn it off. You know what I mean? It's like, what was I thinking? What was I doing? And I think every trainer has that. And so, and I have noticed, I think he's tried to adapt and work over time. And I think that's a positive thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, even as a dog owner for me, I look back on some of the things that we did with our dogs 20 years ago or, and I know Tim, too, we're just like, oh, God, like, thank God our dogs were so patient with us,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I totally agree. So, yeah, Cesar Millan inspired me to do what I do. And for that, I'm very grateful.
So I know that you have decided to kind of specialize in working with dogs with anxiety. And I was wondering how that all came about and why that, you know, why you wanted to concentrate your efforts in that specific way.
Absolutely. There's a couple of main reasons. The first is that I have worked with fairly intense behavior modification cases for a while. And I definitely got to a point where I would often get people coming to me after they'd already tried another trainer, and we would, you know, have to work through their kind of unique case. You know what I mean? It was usually, I'd often get like the particularly unique cases. And so I've always enjoyed like working through, you know, interesting, unique cases. And I always found that anxiety was one of the particularly difficult things. It was really kind of hard. And I think anxiety generally is. My wife is a very anxious person, and she was very, very anxious when we first got married a few years ago. And she's doing much, much better now with it. But I think anxiety is, you know, it's hard because when you have a lack of confidence, you can't approach anything. And even if you try to fix the anxiety, their natural reaction is to shrink. Right. And so you have like an aggressive dog who's really confident about it. It's just about being like, hey, you can't do that anymore. And they're like, oh, all right, cool. But they have something to fall back on, which is their confidence, their personality. Right. Whereas an anxious dog, if they're trying to bite someone, you're like, you can't do that anymore. They're like, well, what am I supposed to do? Cause I don't know. I'm not confident in anything. Right. They just have they're having a constant crisis. Right. And so that's the hard thing with anxiety. And I found that anxiety was a particularly interesting thing to work on, but also particularly difficult thing for owners to understand and work on and solve themselves or solve just, you know, I would give them instructions, but they would have a hard time implementing them. I did some board and trains for anxiety, and I would find that the dog would do really well. It would, you know, within 3 or 4 weeks, it would be doing much, much, much better with me. I would take it back to their home. They would be like, oh my gosh, it's a different dog. But then over the course of a few months, they would have a really hard time maintaining the progress, and they would slowly backtrack. And so I thought, you know, well, okay, obviously we're doing the right things to fix the issue because it's working really well when the dog is with us. But it's the hard thing is that the owners don't have the experience that I have in order to implement all of the techniques that I'm doing. Even when I kind of tell them the techniques, I find that I have to tweak so much when they actually are implementing it that it's really just me spending, you know, tons and tons and tons of time directly with them. And the ones that did succeed with anxious dogs were the ones that were able to implement all those techniques properly, the ones that I was able to spend a lot of time with, that we had tons of texts back and forth with. And so I thought, okay, clearly this is something that's maybe not being serviced as much as it needs to be, the anxiety side of things. Someone also that I'd spoken to, someone that was kind of working with me on giving me some tips on building up a dog business, they had recommended I specialize because they said that, you know, specializing opens up a lot of doors. And I thought that was a cool idea. And so I just naturally, it just made sense. I thought, well, why don't I specialize in anxiety? That's what I've been kind of leaning towards anyways. And so I did, and I love it. The past, you know, little while, especially, you know, we've been getting a lot more of that. And it's been super fun on my end. I know, you know, owners are not happy. It's not a fun thing to have to come to me because that means you have a really tough dog, right? But the really fun thing is being able to help with that and being able to do, well, what I always dreamed of, right, as a kid, which I'm going to take the stress off of owners and make sure they can live the life they dreamed of with their dog. And that's what I get to do now. So that's kind of what got me into specializing in anxiety.
So when people come to you, what are like kind of the, are there any kind of like typical or common behaviors that they've been experiencing with their dog that are particularly problematic?
Yeah, absolutely. So I always say there's two main categories of anxiety, the way I categorize it anyways. There's the fighters and then there's the flighters, which means you've got the dogs that will confront the thing they're scared of, and then the dogs that will just try to run and hide from the thing they're scared of. And so usually you have, you know, the behaviors that you're seeing are often kind of in two main camps, and that are those two categories. So people usually are either experiencing, my dog barks at everything, my dog can't ever seem to actually settle. You know, I've had people tell me like literally a leaf will tap their window while it falls from a tree and the dog will just go berserk, just barking like crazy. You know, they're always on edge. They seem to be always tense. And, you know, when they have guests over, the dog literally doesn't stop barking, maybe at all. They eventually just have to put it in some back room somewhere and maybe it even keeps barking from there, right? You know, things like that are common with the dogs that are more of the fighters. And then with the dogs that tend to run and hide, it's, you know, more things. I mean, it's the obvious things, right? You have thunder they're terrified of, or you can't take them to a pet store or the vet, or you can't take them on a car ride, or you can't have guests over because they'll just run and hide, you know, maybe even, you know, poop or pee, you know, things like that. They're just constantly trying to get away from everything. Even sometimes, you know, the owners can barely take them on a walk because, you know, when they're outside, they just can't stand anything. Their cars, other people, noises, they just freak out and try to run. And so those are usually the things that people come to me, you know, about.
Yeah, I would say our guy Nino falls on the flight end of the spectrum with a lot of things. And so it was definitely, you know, much more, I don't want to say like extreme, but for the dogs that we had had in our house, it seemed extreme, you know, the way that he would react to things. And, you know, like the dishwasher would come on and he would hit the deck, you know, and any kind of like new noise was like very scary for him. And we're assuming, you know, that he didn't live in a house before or hadn't been exposed to these things before. And so for us, it's been such a huge victory just to have him feel safe and happy and confident and comfortable in the house.
Right.
But even here we are 8 years later and he still gets very nervous going in the car. He doesn't like refuse to, but he just definitely doesn't enjoy it, you know, and he's kind of panting and stuff. And we don't take him a lot of places. It's really just the vet and the chiropractor office because we know that he's, you know, not comfortable doing these things. When it's nicer out, we will like go 5 minutes away to this like place where we can kind of hike through this state park area. So he's usually all right with that too. He's like already always been all good on leash, but yeah, uncomfortable around other people, uncomfortable with people coming in our house. You know, like a lot of this has been our life, but I guess for us, it's felt like just a big victory to have him be like safe and happy in the house. And 98% of his life is like that. And then, you know, occasionally he's just going to have to be uncomfortable because we got to go to the vet or something, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So anyway, this topic is just very close to my heart because of everything that we've been through with Nino. And so I was curious, does it matter to you in how you work with dogs? Like, I was thinking like our old girl Penny, she had kind of like what I would call a noise phobia. So she was pretty much a well-adjusted dog, but like she had like a very specific phobia. And then, you know, I've seen dogs that have like separation anxiety, which when I hear anxiety, I think a lot of people think of that first, because that's like a very common term. And then what you were kind of describing, I guess I would call more like generalized anxiety. I was just curious, does any of that labeling or language matter like to you and in how you approach working with dogs?
Yeah, no, definitely it's important to note, you know, what they're anxious about, right? I specialize, like my real specialty and what my programs, I have online courses that are very, and they're blended learning programs. So you get time directly with me virtually, and then you get time in the program. It's very, very comprehensive. It's built to be extremely comprehensive so that people can like really work beginning to end. And what I've built those around and what I've really specialized in, because I found that it was less treated and there were less resources for it, is like that I've tried to find a good name for it. I call it like stimulus anxiety, for lack of a better term. So noise, new people, new places, car rides, things like that, where the surrounding, you know, situation is providing something that causes them anxiety. Separation anxiety, definitely I can help people with that. I've done a lot of that. And that still falls under the category of anxiety, which again is the thing that I really have, you know, studied. It's a little bit different in the sense that it's a slightly different reason for them to be anxious, right? It's not because they're afraid of something. It's because they're nervous being left alone. They're nervous, you know, without something, right? So it's a slightly different kind of thing. But yeah, I definitely work with that as well. The thing that I found was less treated, because there's quite a bit of resources for separation anxiety, but there's less comprehensive resources for the other, for kind of that stimulus anxiety, you know, noise anxiety, guest anxiety, things like that. And I think it's because that stuff is a little more nuanced, a little more complex. And that's why I chose it.
Are there any like early warning signs, you know, like let's say you've just adopted a dog, you know, are there any warning signs other than, you know, oh, it's thunder and the dog freaks out or something, but are there things that, you know, pet parents should be on the lookout for to kind of be like, oh, I should keep an eye on this. And if this gets any worse, then I should seek help. Like what are things pet parents should be on the lookout for?
Yeah. So if you've just adopted a dog and you're waiting to see those things manifest, you want to make sure you're careful when you're, you know, adjusting the dog, because of the fact that there is an adjustment period where you're not going to see all of the, you know, typical behaviors. I had a dog as a teenager that seemed perfectly normal for the first couple of weeks. There were a few signs that I didn't recognize. We can cover those in a sec, but seemed pretty much normal. And then after a couple of weeks, there was one incident. And boom, after that, he was ridiculously aggressive to anybody or anything that wasn't an immediate member of the family. And we never were able, he unfortunately passed away 9 months after that from a random, we weren't sure exactly what happened to him. It was something brain related as far as the vet could tell. We got him to the emergency vet just a little too late. But, you know, so we were never able to quite figure out how to get him. I still wish to this day that I could have worked with him, because I'd be so curious. I'd be so excited to get him past that and get to see him as a totally healthy dog. But it seemed very sudden and it seemed very out of nowhere. So the things to really look out for is you want to see, I would say as a general rule, the first thing is you need to make sure you're introducing your dog to appropriate things. So don't just take them to, you know, a lot of people will get a dog and the next day they take it to the family barbecue. Not necessarily inherently a terrible thing, but you got to be watching their body language. So make sure that they seem very comfortable. Make sure the interactions are supervised. You don't want, you know, Uncle Tom with his, you know, big beard and his cowboy hat walking up and, you know, with his thundering voice and leaning down to give your dog a big smack on the back without you being able to really pay attention. Okay, how does the dog feel about him approaching? How does the dog feel about his voice? Maybe we warn Uncle Tom, hey, Uncle Tom, this is a new dog. Be a little gentle, be a little calm, be a little soft, right? You want to make sure that you're introducing the dog one piece at a time. What people don't realize is that, like, let's take that situation with Uncle Tom, right? Quote unquote, Uncle Tom. This is a very fictitious character. I don't have an Uncle Tom, so nobody worry about me dissing my Uncle Tom. Let's take that situation, right? You have in a dog's mind, it's not one situation. We're thinking, yeah, Uncle Tom walked up and the dog freaked out. I don't know what happened. But what actually happened is Uncle Tom made eye contact with the dog. Uncle Tom talked to the dog. Uncle Tom approached the dog. He then bent down, got really on level with the dog. Then he reached towards the dog's face, right? And that's when the freak out happened. And what you don't realize is that all of those were individual, you know, stimulus for the dog, individual things for the dog to possibly react to. So you have to take it as such. You have to be like, okay, I'm going to watch my dog in each of these things. And I want to make sure I don't see any discomfort form in any of those moments. If we do, we got to stop it at that moment. And maybe we repeat that to help them get comfortable with it. Or maybe we slow it down to help them get comfortable with it. Or maybe we wait till later and try this again. But you have to watch really carefully and recognize that these things that in our mind are one experience are actually many, many different experiences to our dogs. And if you break it down, usually most of the time with new dogs, if you break it down into small pieces, they'll just learn to get past it. So that's the big thing is watch for, you know, watch for the tail, watch for stiffness in the body, right? So if the tail goes low or tucks, if you see them get really still, if you see them pin their ears, if you see them get kind of that whale eye look, right? There's a lot of things. And usually if people are just paying attention, they recognize it. Like they're like, oh, I didn't see that before. But it's pretty, I think most of the time it's pretty easy to tell, like, oh yeah, my dog's uncomfortable. I just wasn't paying attention. So the biggest thing is just pay attention. And then if you do see them uncomfortable, pause the moment, you know, pause the stimulus, maybe move them away for a second. And then I always encourage, if they're not too uncomfortable, try to redo it and see if you can work them into being comfortable just a little bit at a time. And a lot of the time with a nervous dog, they'll just get over it pretty quick as long as you handle it in the right way.
So, you know, what's funny is you're explaining all this and I'm thinking about how this has been playing out in my own life, you know, recently. And we had adopted a new dog about 6 weeks ago and she really likes to run around in our yard and it's been very muddy and she really likes to go behind the shed where all the worst of the mud is. And I had a situation where I'm, you know, still just like kicking myself a little bit, you know, because with all of our dogs, when they get muddy paws, we keep a bunch of towels by the back door and we wipe their feet. And, you know, to me, that's like such a normal, natural thing that we do in this house. But she had never experienced that before and it was really scary for her. And I also discovered that she had a sore on one of her paws and was really, she doesn't like her paws being touched. And, you know, so now I feel like I have created this thing where she's terrified to see a towel coming at her because I wasn't thinking, you know, what that would be like for her and that she had never experienced it because we do it all the time. And my old girl Penny loved towels and to her it was like this big warm fuzzy hug, you know, and so I wasn't thinking, you know, and it's like, oh, I could just kick myself for that. And so now because she insists on going out and getting muddy because it's been like, I swear this whole year of 2024 has just been a constant rainstorm for us. You know, I have like, we have to get the licky mat and distract her. You know, one of us has to distract her. I can use a washcloth because it's smaller and not as scary as the towel, you know, and try to do it that way and do it real quick. But man, is she sending me all the signals? The ears are pinned back. The mouth is really tight. I'm getting a little bit of whale eye, you know, and it's like,
like, I know that she's really uncomfortable, but she's, you know, willing to go through this, you know, and we give treats and she's got the peanut butter licky mat, you know, and it's like, we're trying to make this as positive, but it's just funny because I'm like, oh, I can exactly see how this has played out in my own life recently.
Right. And it can be hard when, you know, especially because you're not on the dog 24/7 in your mind, you know, just because it's a new dog doesn't mean you're paying direct attention 24/7. And those things are going to happen where you're like, I wasn't even thinking to pay attention. Right. And now this happened. So I think, you know, it's also important for owners not to feel terrible if they missed a moment. It's okay. A dog is never ruined. You know what I mean? Their life or their experience with that thing is never ruined. We can always redo it, get them back to normal levels and help them learn to, you know, enjoy things again and be okay. So I think, you know, I think just like with ourselves, right? We have bad moments too. We have moments where, oh man, if that had just gone this way, I think I would have handled that a lot better, right? I mean, you have, especially relationships, right? We have that all the time. You know, I think if you hadn't brought that up right as I was getting home from work and blah, 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 I think
and I had eaten. So
bad, right? Exactly. And so same thing with our dogs, right? And it's okay to just, I think the best thing in that moment is you go, okay, well, let's recognize what did go wrong. What could I do differently in the future? But not to beat ourselves up, not to be like, ah, if only I had done this. It's just like, okay, well, let's recognize what I did and didn't do, and then recognize what I could do in the future. And I'll try to implement that. And now what can I do to help the situation that already is?
So, you know, I have never raised a dog from puppy. I have no interest in ever having a puppy, quite frankly. And, you know, it's like, give me a 4-year-old dog. I'm totally fine. Yeah,
so it can be exhausting.
Yeah. It sounds like I don't have kids either for a reason. Like, it sounds exhausting. And so I was just curious, you know, I've heard people say that, like, you know, they'll have a puppy and it'll seem like everything's going fine. And then all of a sudden one day it just seems like they've developed a fear of something that can't kind of came out of nowhere. At least from the owner's perspective. So Is there like a common age when these sort of things get embedded in them with fears or phobias? Like, are there some dogs that are just really anxious about things from birth, or like, is it always like that something happens, or do you have any insight into like when things like this start to occur in a dog's development?
Absolutely. There's definitely, there are usually like a couple, I find there's usually a couple of like places in the dog's development where they kind of go through this like skittish phase. I'm terrible at remembering exact numbers. And I always, every time I talk to someone about this, I have to look it up. I don't remember exactly what they are off the top of my head. I want to say, I'm pretty sure the one is like 7 to 8 months. The thing is, it's different with every dog, right? Partly large breed, small breed, you know, dogs develop a little bit faster or slower than others. Every dog hits it a little bit differently. I want to say that the one is like 7 to 8 months. And then there, I think there's one other, and I want to say it's like 3 to 4 months. You can Google it and find that info pretty easily. And I'm so sorry if breeders are like being driven nuts right now, because they're like, what is he talking about? That's not the ages. But yes, there's a couple ages. You can find that info pretty easily online. Again, I don't specialize in puppies, so that's probably what I don't memorize. But usually there's like two ages where they kind of, my theory is like, I think what kind of happens, there's probably something chemically going on in the brain, but I think what basically happens is, and this makes sense to me, is like they have a lot of courage for a little while. And then they start to realize that the world could totally like tear them apart. And they're like, oh, I should probably be scared. And so then they practice being scared of everything. They're like, maybe I need to actually be terrified of like everything, because everything could possibly hurt me. And I've seen, you know, my dogs kind of figure this stuff out in real time. My dog, Mabel, my old English bulldog, she did this one time where she walked up to, there was like a thistle, like one of those big, you know, like 2 feet wide, you know, just a very thorny, like, you know, weed on the ground, like super pokey, right? And she waltzed right up to it, wondering what it was, and just, you know, she's got that short snout, just shoved her snout into the thistle to sniff it. And she jumped back like, whoa, what was that? And then she slowly reapproached it, like belly to the ground. She like slowly approached it again, sniffed it again, really explored it. And about a week later, we were at that same place, and she went to that same thistle. And this time she saw it, she paused, she got really slow. She slowly walked up, she slowly sniffed it, and then she slowly moved away. And she was learning like in real time, okay, things can hurt me. I shouldn't just shove my face into them. Right. And I think that's where puppies hit this stage where they start being able to walk and they're like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Everything is so cool. And then they're like, oh, things can eat me. And then they're like, everything is super scary. And they get really scared for a little while. And I think the biggest things is usually, you know, unless you have a dog that's, because certain dogs are more predisposed to anxiety than others for sure. I think one of the biggest things is just, first thing is don't stop introducing them to things, but help them work through things. So you don't want to, again, don't throw them in the deep end of the pool without any sort of help. Guide them into the deep end of the pool and help them learn how to swim, right? So it's like, you know, helping them learn through exploration. A great one is to, you know, a really simple one is just take some kibble and toss it on the ground next to something they're a little hesitant about. Help them learn how to turn on their exploratory mode rather than their fearful mode. And typically most dogs, as long as you don't freak out about it, as long as you don't super baby them, and as long as you also make sure that they don't have terrible experiences during that time, maybe you don't let Uncle Tom say hi to them during that time, right? There's certain people that I just won't introduce to dogs during certain periods because I just know they're not going to be good for them. So as long as you avoid those terrible experiences and as long as you don't totally baby them, most puppies just work right through it without a problem. And after a month or so, a couple of months, they'll get back to normal.
You know, it's just so funny. I'm thinking about children and my nephew, and he was kind of like, you know, big, loud, boisterous, you know, when he was like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9. And, you know, we have this picture of him, I think it was his 8th birthday, where he's like standing up on a chair and he's like kind of conducting everybody, singing happy birthday to him, you know, and it was really cute. And then by the time he was 10, it was like, don't look at me, you know, I don't want any attention on myself. Like, you know, we were at a restaurant and I have a picture of this one too, you know, where they're all singing happy birthday to him and he's like hiding.
That's hilarious.
You know, it just like within that short period of time, it goes from like, yeah, woo, like no concern about the outside world, and to, oh my God, nobody look at me.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to me that other species could go through something like that too, where Absolutely. It's like, you know, exciting, and then it's like, oh, that's I don't want that.
Yeah, absolutely. I did quickly look it up, by the way, so I can make sure I'm giving good information. It sounds like generally the consensus is the two fear periods in puppies are usually between 8 to 11 weeks, and then sometime in the span of 6 to 14 months old that usually lasts a few weeks. So anywhere between, you know, 6 months and a little over a year. That's kind of the other one. So usually the most common I've seen is like 7 to 8 months, but it can kind of happen anytime in that for usually a few weeks. So,
well, I'll try to find a link to that too and put in the show notes.
I checked a few different links just to make sure I was kind of getting some semi accurate, make sure it was the general consensus, but that tracks with what I've kind of seen anecdotally. So, yeah. And I think species, you know, species of species, it definitely, and you think about too, the time of development with like the kid you were talking about, right? We live a lot longer than dogs do. So that would kind of track with, you know, the span of development of puppies versus humans, right? I think it's kind of the same type of thing. So
one thing you had mentioned, and I was curious about this, you know, like whether there's like a genetic component. And I was thinking like of Chihuahuas or like the little dogs. You see a lot of the little dogs that are like always, you know, shaking and fearful and seem to have like some kind of anxiety. So is there any kind of like breed or disposition or anything like that that you've noticed with anxiety?
Yeah. There's definitely breeds that tend to be more anxious than others overall. Just like there's, you know, all sorts of other breed related characteristics. There's, you know, I would say if I were to pick some breeds that kind of tend to be more nervy, like Great Danes are a great example of a breed that looks real tough, but tends to be pretty nervy. I've seen a lot of fairly anxious Great Danes. They tend to be, you know, it's always the Chihuahua chasing the Great Dane, right? The Great Dane tail tucked trying to run away, right?
Right.
And so, you know, Great Danes tend to be that way. I think a lot of shepherds tend to have, I think they're just prone to, honestly, I think what it seems to be is they're prone to overthinking things. So the Australian shepherds, the German shepherds are just thinking so much. And this tracks with what I know about a lot of humans that I know, where when you overthink things, you tend to get really anxious, right? And I think when they're not stimulated, they tend to just like think way too hard and they just get themselves into a tizzy. I think that there's definitely some breeds, but more than breed, what I always focus on is individual, because you can get a breed that is so spot on for the breed related characteristics. And then you can also get a breed or an individual, sorry, in that breed that is totally the opposite of all the breed related characteristics.
Sure.
I've seen that happen a lot. And I think I get a lot of clients who have gotten a breed for certain characteristics and they're like, oh, this dog isn't what we expected. And it's because they picked a breed, but didn't think so much about the individual dog. And so I think it's really important, especially with things like anxiety, broader things like that, when you're not talking about like herding skills or something really specific, anxiety is a much broader one. And you have to remember that anxiety it stems from survival instinct. Fear is an essential part of our survival, right? If we didn't have any fear, we die off really quickly, right? We need fear. Anxiety is just kind of the unhealthy version of that survival instinct. And so it's natural to have it. It's just, does the dog have too much of it or too little? And I've definitely, I talked to Well, there's a, I'll give a little plug for Julie Swan, the honest dog breeder. I did a podcast with her. I think it's coming out in February or something. And we were talking a lot about this because obviously she's on the breeding side. I'm on the anxiety side. So genetics came up a lot. And she was talking about genetics that she sees with her dog. She does German Shorthair Pointers. And I believe Rat Terriers is the other one she does. And she was talking about, like, she had one female German Shorthair Pointer that all of her puppies were submissive urinators, like really bad. And it seemed to like not go away in them. And she eventually pulled her from the breeding program because she was like, they're great in every other way, but I just feel like I'm not doing a great thing by, you know, giving out this submissive urination trait. Right. And so it definitely can be very, very genetic. I always say that I think dogs can always get to a point. I always say you can always get a dog to a livable point, to like a manageable, livable, pretty happy point. But some dogs will always be much more prone to anxiety than others. The biggest thing is individual. More than breed, it's always, I look at individuals. And yeah, you can definitely get, you know, individual dogs that got, you know, the whole litter gets a genetic predisposition to anxiety. So
there's been this meme going around that I have seen lately where it's like, oh, I got a dog to help me with my anxiety, but now my dog has anxiety. And yep. I was just, you know, curious. And I think we've even kind of, you know, alluded to it a little bit here. Like, what are the things that pet parents are doing that are just making this worse? And I was even just thinking from the standpoint, right, of like Uncle Tom, right? Like he wants to reach over and pet the dog on the head, and how that's like a very, primate trait, right? To like reach out and want to like touch. Whereas dogs don't do that to each other. That would not be how dogs interact, you know, with each other. Yep. And so it's like, as people, we're doing things that like to us seem like our instinct, but we're like such a whole different species from dogs and how they communicate. And so what is it that people are doing to make this worse and to make it so common that there's like this whole meme about it on the internet?
Yeah, no, I've seen that meme too. I think my first response is always, God has a really funny sense of humor. but I think, because I think sometimes the people with anxiety somehow do pick the anxious dogs. And I don't know if it's because like on a deep level, they just relate to them. But they do, it seems like uncanny how they always end up with the more prone to anxiety dogs. And I don't know if it's just, like I said, maybe it's just some sort of, I feel like I can relate to this dog on a deep level and they don't really know why exactly. Maybe it's just because they have overall similar personalities. But definitely, I think one of the hard things is that, and this is a hard topic because I don't want people to think that if you're, what I'm going to say is that if you're anxious, it's more likely that you're going to make your dog more anxious. You know, being anxious, you need someone around you that is the stable one that you can lean on. And so if you're both anxious and neither of you can really reliably lean on each other, it's going to be harder. And I hate saying that because it makes people feel like, oh, there's no hope for us, when there totally, totally, totally is. You can be an anxious person and still be a confident leader and guide and protector for your dog. You know what I mean? You know, I always say, like, you can be anxious in this direction, but then confident in this direction, where when you turn to your dog, you're okay, focus, let's lock it down and project that confident energy. And then, okay, I'm going to take the rest of my life and be my normal self with it. Right. I always think that it's great. I think when people get an anxious dog, it's a really awesome chance for them to learn more about their own anxiety and to work on it. And to, I mean, who wants to live with anxiety? Right. It's not that it can always be solved per se. It's not that it, you know, I know that anxiety is a very, very complex thing, and I never, ever want to claim that I have some sort of, you know, that you can just solve it right for yourself. But I do think that just like with dogs, you can pretty much always improve it, from what I've seen with even just the owners that I've worked with. And it's a great chance to work on your own anxiety. As far as the things that people are doing to increase the anxiety in their dog, one of them is, you know, being very high strung, being anxious about your dog and their behaviors. That is a tough one. And one of the tips I always give people is, like, especially with the dogs, for example, that will, you know, bark incessantly at the door or at somebody walking by the window, don't immediately go and interact with your dog when they're doing that. The first thing you need to do is take a deep breath, and you need to focus on making sure you're in the right state of mind. Then I want you to, I always say, read and react. So read the dog, read the situation, and think before you react. This is a big thing that I teach both owners and dogs. I think it's really important that we all learn how to read before. It's the whole shoot first, ask questions later, right? You need to ask questions first. So you need to go, okay, what's my dog thinking right now? What's the situation right now? What would be the best way for me to approach my dog so that I can de-escalate the situation rather than escalate it? Because what most of the time happens is someone goes, oh my gosh, my dog is barking. And they run over, they go, hey, sit, stop, sit, come. come, stop, sit, you want a treat, right? They just start freaking out at their dog, right? And you're basically just barking with your dog at that point. You're just freaking out with them and you're just making it worse, right? Your dog is like, great, glad we're on the same page. Let's keep barking, right? So, you know, when you're an anxious person, I think being able to just take that moment and read and react is super important. You can apply that to most situations. If you're out with your dog and they're on a leash, obviously timing is important with, you know, helping a dog learn to not be reactive or anxious or whatever. But in almost every situation, it would be so much better for you to take that extra half second to a couple of seconds to make sure you're good and then read the situation and then react than it would be to react immediately and do it wrong. Right. I'd rather do it right a little bit late than do it wrong right now. So read and react, you know, first instead of just immediately doing something. And then, like you talked about too, using dog instinct, not human instinct. So take some time to learn how dogs communicate. Take some time to learn what their body language looks like when they're uncomfortable. Each dog looks a little different when they're uncomfortable too. So take some time to learn your dog's language and signs. And then learn to put your dog's needs ahead of your own needs. I think the other hard thing when an anxious person gets an anxious dog is they both have needs, right? And the anxious person needs their needs to be met. But what tends to happen is that sometimes the dog's needs get a little bit swept aside because the anxious person, without knowing it, I don't think anyone does this intentionally, prioritizes their own needs. You know, well, I need a cuddle buddy right now, right? When maybe that's not the right thing for the dog, but it's the right thing for the person. So it ends up being the thing that happens. So those would be my main tips, I think, for someone who is anxious and maybe making their dog a little bit worse.
Yeah, I was thinking that it's like a cycle of like, you know, the dog is anxious and it makes the person anxious, which makes the dog anxious, which makes the person anxious.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's not that you need to be, people get this concept that like they need to be like this really dominant, you know, big alpha male. And that's not the case. That's not what you need to be. You just need to be the stable side of the relationship. You need to be the one that your dog, when you say something to your dog goes, oh, you know what you're doing and I don't. Even if you don't know what you're doing, they just need to feel that vibe from you that, oh, you're relaxed and you're confident and I'm not, which means clearly you're the one who should be listened to right now. That makes a world of difference. And no matter what training techniques you're using, no matter what tools you use, no matter what you're doing, if you're calm and confident, it will be 10 times more effective.
So when we were chatting a couple weeks ago, you said something to me that I was kind of like, that's a mic drop moment right there about anxiety. And it was kind of like the number one mistake that families and pet parents are making when it comes to anxiety is fill in the blank.
Uh-oh. What did I say?
Is choosing the wrong dog.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I have a lot of things, but that is, yeah, that would be the number one. And you know what? It's funny. I think the reason I don't think of it immediately is because of the fact that that's the advice that I can never give in time. People don't come to me until after they have the dog. Almost never talk to someone before they get a dog. That is the number one mistake, is getting the wrong dog. I heard a trainer the other day, I don't remember who it was. I think it was someone on social media. So I wish I could credit them for it. But they did a post that said, I think he said, I think maybe 10 people that I've ever met have gotten the right dog for them. Like it's very rare that someone actually gets a dog that really works for them. And I think it's really important that people take the time necessary to pick the right dog, whether you're adopting, buying, doesn't matter, you know, obviously, you know, even more so if you're, really it doesn't even matter where you're getting the dog. It's always important that you take your time, A, to know where you're getting it from, but B, get the right individual dog. Most of the time people get a dog that is not as compatible with their lifestyle as it could be. And there's so many dogs that need homes. You're going to find one that's compatible with you, right? Even if you've got a really wacky particular situation, you will find one that's compatible. Just take the time. I always recommend, if you can, talk to a professional, talk to a trainer. Ask someone, hey, you know, that knows what they're talking about. Hey, what kind of dog would you recommend for me? What level you need to look at? What level energy? Size is important, of course. Think those types of things that you need to look at. But what level energy, the temperament, the personality of the dog, in the sense that, do you need a dog? Are you going to be okay with a dog that's a little bit more strong-willed? Are you going to be able to handle that? Or do you need a dog that's a little more ready to kind of go with the flow? You know, what affection level do I need? All of these different things. What anxiety level do I need? Some people are built to handle a really confident dog. Some people are built to handle a really fearful dog. Some people are built to handle a really strong-willed dog. I have, you know, my older dog is a high-energy, strong-willed guy. And I love him to pieces. He's a great fit for me, right? He keeps me busy. And so everybody needs to find the right dog for them. So yeah, that I would totally agree with that statement. I think that's the number one mistake that people are making. That unfortunately is not a message I get to really get out very often. So I'm like, glad when I can.
So in your work, like what percentage of the time do you think like, oh, they got the wrong dog? Like, is it 90% of the time?
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. I hate to say that too, because it's like, I don't want people to think I always tell people my job, my first priority is to try to keep the dog in your home. There have been a few times where I will tell someone, got to be honest with you, this is not the right fit. I'll work with you. And if you want to keep this dog, we will work as hard as we can and make it fit. But this is not the right fit, in my professional opinion. And I have had people, I think we need to destigmatize rehoming, to be honest. I think that definitely when you get a dog, you are committing to care for that dog for its whole life. But then there's a big but there. Things change, and we have to recognize that. And we have to stop demonizing people for life circumstances changing and they didn't really foresee it, right? Unexpected behaviors come up, unexpected, you know, sometimes you just get a dog and you just don't realize you're incompatible with that dog. And I've seen people, you know, have to, they rehome a dog because they genuinely are not compatible with it and they are heartbroken. And then people rip them a new one on the internet for doing it. And it really ticks me off, to be honest, because in my mind, it's like, if this is a better situation for the owners, the dog and the new owners, then why would we not do it? Right. Mm-hmm. And that's really my big thing is like, if you think about it, you just say, okay, is this going to be better for everybody involved? Then it's a no brainer. And if it is, then do it. Right. And every dog I've ever overseen or helped with the rehoming process of, including my own two dogs that I got from other owners who couldn't keep them anymore. It's a net positive for everybody involved. Everybody's happier. I can't imagine if the people who had my dogs hadn't had to rehome them. I would be so sad because I wouldn't have these two awesome dogs. They are so great and I wouldn't have them. And same thing with many dogs, you know, even as a teenager, we had to rehome one or two family dogs that just weren't a fit. I'm still in contact to this day with someone who has one of the dogs that I bawled my eyes out for weeks rehoming this dog, but it's so happy with her and she's so happy and my family was better off, you know, for it. So I think destigmatizing that too is really important because there are certain situations, even though if you have gotten the wrong dog, because like I said, I think most people do, most of the time you can make it work. And by then you're already in love with the dog. The dog's in love with you. You might as well make it work, right? It may not be the perfect fit, but that doesn't mean that it can't still be a great, overall great fit, right? But yeah, I would say a lot of people get the wrong dog.
Yeah, I see it where people get working breeds. And then they're at work all day and the dog's in the sofa and then, oh, the dog is like destroying their basement and they don't know why. And, you know, that's something where I have thought that to myself, like, that you got a working German Shepherd, you know, like, yeah. It's not going to be a couch potato. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Some of the considerations as we're not always super realistic, I guess, in some of our considerations for what we're looking for, you know. Right. I've definitely seen that a lot.
Right. And that's why I'm so big on choose a personality, choose an individual dog, because people do get, even if you get the right, you know, breed, oh yeah, this is a good breed for us, you get labs who are the best couch potatoes you've ever met, right? But then you get labs that are kind of like German Shepherds. They just need to work all the time. And I have a pit bull who is a working guy, but I've also met pit bulls who are the best couch potatoes ever. And, you know, that's a slightly worse comparison because pit bull is such a variety, but, you know, but yeah, I think choosing an individual dog. And the other thing too is do not get your emotions involved almost at all in your decision to get a dog. That decision needs to be a cold, calculated thing because what people do, and I cannot tell you how many people I've met whose dog quote unquote chose them when really they just got the most hyper dog of the bunch, right? Is what they did because that dog, and I went with this breeder that I was chatting with Julie Swan. She said, people will tell me, oh my gosh, you know, the dog, they'll be meeting her puppies and they'll be like, oh, that this dog chose us. And she goes, yeah, he also chose the last two people who came today. It's like that dog chooses everyone, quote unquote, right. Chooses, right? So yeah. I think you have to make sure that you're really careful to get a dog. You figure out first, what can I give? Second, what does that mean for the type of dog that I need to be looking for? And then take your time. It might be, you know, 3 to 6 months before the right dog comes into the rescue, your local rescue. Take the time. And also, you know, work with the people at the rescue will have some idea too. They don't know, unfortunately, as much as they could about the dog, just because there's high turnover. The dogs are in a stressed out environment. They don't really know the dog's real personality most of the time, but they can give you some idea based off of the energy level, the amount of drive, those types of things. Really take some time to get the dog that you need. And also aim low. So don't get a dog that might be a little challenging, but you think you can handle it. That's usually a bad decision. Get the dog that you're like, we can definitely handle this dog. I often tell people, another way I kind of phrase it is, get the dog that works. You know, people say like, I want to get a dog that I can take running with me. Okay, great. But you're going to do that for like 1 hour out of 23 every day, right? Get a dog that fits with 23 hours of your day, not 1 hour of your day. Most dogs will be okay to go running with you, right? So if you get a dog that is okay for the 23 hours, it'll probably work for that 1 hour too. But get a dog that works for the majority of your life and not the one activity that you're dreaming of doing with the dog for 1 hour a day. That's a really, really important one.
Yes, that is. And I'm making that note to myself as well.
It's hard. It's so hard not to get your emotions involved too when you're adopting a dog. You know, it's so hard. And it's hard too because you're excited to get a dog and you see this dog and it's so cute and it's very excited. And it's like, or even it's not excited. It seems like the perfect dog, right? But just do your homework, use your head, you know, like I said, be a cold, calculated killer when you're getting a dog. You got to make sure you get the dog that is right for you, not the dog that you're feeling like is right for you. Feelings can lead you right sometimes, but more often than not, I see them lead people wrong with my clients.
So I know that you have this program where you work with pet owners with anxiety, and you were telling me about the three pillars of your program. So can you share some of that with us?
Absolutely. I'm going to pull it up too on my phone so I have my notes on that because I love talking about this. So there's the reason I kind of developed the three pillars is because I was doing things like this. I was talking to people. I was, talking about what I do to help dogs with anxiety, things like that. And I found that I needed to boil it down a little bit better. And so I sat down one day, I was like, okay, what is my, I knew I could work with an anxious dog, but I was like, I need to write down my process and figure out like what this actually looks like in real time, figure out some bullet points. So this is kind of what I came up with. There's three main pillars for me for working with an anxious dog. First one is owner education. Owner education is so important because like I talked about, I've worked with so many dogs where I can get the dog to the point it needs to be. And most trainers can get a dog to the point, a lot of trainers can get a dog to the point it needs to be, but can't get the owners to the point where they need to be. And sometimes owners are just incompatible, of course, but most of the time it's just that the right amount of time, the right amount of, you know, practice is just not happening to get the owners where they really need to be in order to help this dog. So owner education is huge for me. There's a few main bullet points in owner education. First one is helping them learn to be calm and confident, helping the owner learn to come at it with the right energy, the right perspective, the right attitude. Second big one is helping them learn to read body language, helping them learn to like look at what a dog is communicating to them in the moment so that they can, you have to read it really precisely and you have to read it in real time. So it's like if you miss a cue, 5 seconds later, behavior is going to happen and it could have been prevented if you'd seen that cue, right? And it could have been not only prevented in the moment, but it could have been helped to become much better if you had seen that cue, right, in the long run. So body language is huge. Read and react, like I talked about, making sure that you pause, that you actually take some time to read the body language, read the situation, calm yourself down, then react. That's another huge bullet point. We talk a lot about tools, making sure you're using the right tools for your dog. Every dog is a little different. Every dog requires a different type of leash, collar, all sorts of different, calming treats, anything you can think of, right? There's a million different products for dogs and a lot of them work, but not all of them work on all the dogs at all the times, right? So all sorts of different tools we go through, understanding the why of a behavior. I think this is really important this is one of the few behaviors that I don't think you can fix without understanding what's going on in the dog's mind. A lot of other behaviors you can kind of fix just by implementing a technique. This one, you really have to understand what's happening in the dog's mind. And so that's a huge one to talk about. And then another big one is just I always call it perspective of opportunity, which means when I'm training with an owner and like, let's say we're out in a pet store and I've got their dog's leash and maybe their dog is terrified of, or let's say their dog is like reactive towards other dogs. It's like anxious, reactive towards other dogs. And another dog walks into the pet store. I smile and I'm like, oh, let's go. Let's take this opportunity. Let's go do this. Right. And I'm like, how can we use this to help the dog progress and get less anxious and be a happier dog? The owner is always like, oh, we're going towards the dog. Like, yeah, this is an opportunity. This is a learning moment for all of us. Like, of course we're going to go towards the dog, right? We're not going to go up and have them greet face to face. We're going to do what the dog is ready for, but we're going to always use opportunities that come by. So learning how to, and this is part of being confident, is learning how to see perspective of opportunity, learning how to recognize that instead of this being a scary moment, this is an opportunity for all of us to learn and grow. So that's huge. The second pillar is foundational calm. And this is kind of one, I'm proud of this one. I think I've kind of dubbed this one, and it's a little bit of, it's kind of my baby as far as the pillars go. Foundational calm is providing the structure and the basic mental emotional needs of the dog and helping them feel stable and secure in their environment. So it's things like making sure that the basics are making sure they have the right types of exercise and the right amount of exercise, making sure they have good rules and boundaries so that they don't feel like their life is just chaos. Making sure that they have the daily skills they need for structure and stress reduction. So like, for example, the place command, so useful, because if your dog is scared of guests, having them be able to go to a safe place while they can still observe everything and having them be confident in, even though they're not confident in the guest coming, they're confident in going to the place and staying there, right? So having various things that they can do to make themselves feel less stressed and more structured. A good heel is important. You're walking through a pet store, sometimes just putting a dog in heel helps them feel like, okay, I have a place. I can do this if I'm focused on doing this job that I'm supposed to do with my owner. So daily skills. And then relieving unnecessary stressors, making sure that you're not putting too much on them at once, making sure that you're taking things one step at a time. Like we talked about earlier, each incident is really like 20 small incidents in a dog's mind. So making sure that you take each of those and, okay, how much can my dog handle right now? And only do that much. And then my favorite part of this probably is emotional self-control. So, which is basically just impulse control is kind of what the general dog community calls it. So it's reducing obsession, curbing overexcitement. It's helping the dog learn to ask questions first and then shoot, not shoot first, ask questions later. So it's helping them learn how to actually use their brain and not just react when an instinct hits them. So that's kind of the foundational calm pillar. And that one's a really essential one because a lot of the dogs I found, some of the dogs that I worked with, we actually worked less directly on the anxiety and we more worked on a background of foundational calm. And that was really the key to their success. The key to their growth was just overall having them have a level of calm. Another big reason that's important is because most dogs and every anxious dog owner that I've talked to will relate to this. If you think about anxiety as a level, like 1 through 10, your dog is somewhere there when they're reacting to something or they're running away, they're at a 10. But most anxious dogs, they're not usually at a 0. They're sitting at a 5. They live at a 5. They're always pretty anxious. It's just when something happens, they get extremely anxious. Whereas normal healthy dogs are living more towards a 1 or a 0 all the time. They might be, you know, they're always a little bit alert maybe, but they're not anxious. And then when something happens, they bump up to a 4 or a 5, they have a normal reaction, and then they come back down quickly to 1 or 0, right? And so that's why foundational calm is so important, because that's the thing that takes your dog from living at a 5 to living at a 1 or 0. And so it makes the reactions less extreme, but it also makes them less frequent because your dog is just learning how to see the world through proper perspective. And then the third big pillar is increasing courage. Increasing courage is essential because anxiety is essentially, if you think about it, it's a lack of assurance, it's a lack of courage, it's a lack of confidence, right? So increasing courage is really important. Part of that is kind of the bite-sized fears, like we talked about a minute ago. So making sure you only give them what they're ready for, making sure you're, I always say challenge them, but don't overwhelm them. So challenge, you know, help them grow because you have to, you know, have to have friction to grow. So help them grow, but don't overwhelm them to the point of freak out. And then helping them learn to approach something with curiosity. This one's super fun because this is when owners get a little teary, is when they see their dog for like maybe the first time ever approach something that they typically would be afraid of, but without suspicion, instead with curiosity. And that's like my big thing, is get the dog to go into curious mode instead of suspicion mode. And that's even just simple things. Like I said, scatter feeding, you throw some treats near the thing there. If it's a mild fear, throw some treats down or some kibble down near the thing they're afraid of and have them, you know, sniff it out and find it and eat it. That gets them into a more curious mode. So helping them learn to see the world through curiosity, not suspicion. And part of that is utilizing fun. I love to utilize fun. Anything we can do to get them to play, to get them to focus on finding treats, to get them to enjoy themselves in a stressful situation, that's like the best thing for anxiety ever. And the same thing with anxious people, I think. You know what I mean? If you get out of your own head and you just start to have some fun and goof off and play, that's really fantastic. Another kind of segment of that is, I call it guiding autonomy, which is helping them. This is where they start to not rely quite as much on your confidence, but actually develop their own, helping them learn how to handle a situation without so much input from you. And that part is where we really see the dogs start to fly. You know, like it's like that's where they really spread their wings and fly, is when we start helping them learn to have their own autonomy. And then rewarding relaxation, making sure that anytime they're relaxed in a mildly stressful environment, that we're rewarding that. And it can be, you can reward that many, many, many different ways, but making sure we're showing them like, yes, relaxation is good. That's a positive thing. So those are kind of my three pillars. Those are the things we work people through in the program. And of course, that's a lot, right? That's why my program is pretty long and it's very comprehensive. But that's, you know, that's, those are the things that I have found are key to helping an anxious dog. And I've taken dogs from, you know, anxious at everything to one of my favorite moments we've had was a dog that I worked with for, I brought him in for like a 4-week rehab. I brought him home to the owners and we put, brought him inside. We were inside for a little while. And this was one of the dogs that was so noise reactive. Noise reactive just in that he would bark. He would never, no real aggression, just barking, but he would, any sort of tiny noise, a tap. I mean, you could drop a pin literally and he would start barking. It was like a woof, 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 very measured. And he would bark as long as you let him. And then it would take a while to settle him down. He would literally bark for half an hour. Oh my God. He would stand in one place. He wouldn't try to check it out. He wouldn't try to find the source. He would just stand there and bark like a little alarm. It was kind of adorable in a pathetic way. But we worked with him a lot. And when we brought him back to the house, we were sitting in their living room. We'd been there for half an hour. And he was clearly very happy to be home. He was very content. And something, I don't know what it was, something tapped the door. It was a pretty good tap. It sounded like a single knock, right? And all of us kind of paused. Okay, what's he going to do, right? Because we've worked on this a lot. What is he going to react to this? We all kind of paused. We looked at him. And he turned. He looked at the door. He kind of cocked his head. And he thought about it. And about 10 seconds went by of him just kind of looking at the door. And then he just turned and he just kind of walked off and did something else. And the owner's jaws hit the floor. They were like... Because what they said, they told me, they were like, we have never seen him think before barking. We've never seen him consider, is that something I want to bark at? And so that to me is really important, is that your dog hits the point where they are actually, they're using their own brain, they're using their own confidence, and they can actually genuinely be relaxed. It's not just that they're not reacting to something, it's that they're genuinely relaxed. And that is like, that moment is worth so much. That keeps me going. That drives me so hard.
Yeah, I think from my, you know, pet parent kind of perspective, that's to me what's like my biggest struggle is, like, for instance, this crazy dog I have in the other room with squirrels, and, you know, she is just so constantly on alert, and it's like, how do you like interrupt that pattern, you know, or interrupt that instinct or that impulse? Like, to me as a pet parent, that's definitely like when you see they're in this aroused state, like how do you stop that or redirect it or create that pause? So yeah, I can definitely see that that's definitely like a big struggle from the pet parent end.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many moving parts too. I mean, like I said, those are just kind of my main bullet points, and that took me like a while, right, to talk through all of those things, because it is a complex issue, especially with anxiety. It's a very complex thing. There's so many moving parts, and you know, not to like, you know, plug my own work too hard, but I always recommend work with a professional when you're working with anxiety, because it is one of those particularly difficult. That's why I specialize in it, is because it's particularly difficult. And I think particularly confusing for owners. And the other thing too, is like, I'll make videos with a tip on how to handle anxiety. Or I do a lot of virtual training. Obviously my, you know, programs are virtual. And I'll give someone like a exercise to try with their anxious dog. And pretty much every time I have to either watch them do it and tweak the way they're doing it, or I have to have them send me some videos of them doing it and tweak the way they're doing it. Almost every time I can give someone exact instructions, but they're just, they don't, because they've never done it before, they're going to do a couple of small things wrong without even knowing it. And I have to point those out, and then they recognize them, and then they can do it better, and then they're great. And then it's smooth sailing from there with that exercise, right? But there's so many moving parts to these things. It's not as simple as, you know, just the little simple behaviors that we talk about, jumping and, you know, leash pulling and things like that. There are simple fixes for a lot of behaviors. Anxiety is not a simple fix thing. It's because it's a very complex issue.
So what should pet parents look for when they want to work with a trainer on anxiety? And does it matter like what the cause of the anxiety is about how they should approach it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing I always recommend when you're looking for a trainer, the first basic things I recommend, you want to look for someone who clearly has experience in the area that you are looking for. And you can even just get that looking at the reviews. If you look at reviews, a lot of people will tell you what their dog was struggling with and what the owner or what the trainer worked on. Every trainer is a little bit better at a few particular things. Most trainers that I know, even if they don't say they specialize, they usually have some things that they're either known for or they're just really good at it. So look to see if, you know, hopefully you want to look for a trainer that has experience with the thing that you're looking for help with. The second thing is looking at reviews, making sure people are actually happy with them, right? Get actual testimonials, because no matter how good someone is on the books, no matter what kind of letters they have after their name, you want to see that they're actually in real life. Ian Dunbar actually talked about this recently, and I really liked. He was like, we're getting too theoretical with dog training. He was like, I want to see results. I want to see people actually testing things, actually doing things. And so you want to see someone who's really boots on the ground. They are solving the problems that you have. And then the second big thing is get someone you vibe with. It doesn't matter. You know, I think no matter what techniques they use, no matter what, you know, kind of training mantra they have, if you don't vibe with somebody, again, owner education is so important. If you don't click with somebody, you are not going to be able to work well with them, right?
I'm laughing, just so you know, because I have met some dog trainers with some interesting personalities. And so yes, I think that part is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've met people who have worked with trainers that I know to be very good trainers, but they're like, I didn't really like the way she, whatever. I didn't really like the way he did this. I didn't really like, it's like, okay, then don't work with that trainer. That's not a huge deal, right? And so, I'm sure there are people who say the same thing about me. I consider myself a pretty charismatic guy, I guess, but I'm sure there's people who are like, I didn't really like the way he said this. I didn't like the way he did this. That's totally fine. I'm not the right trainer for everybody. No trainer is the right trainer for everybody, right?
We went to a trainer one time who was a guy that had a military background, and that is really not, like, my husband does not react well to like that kind of personality or whatever. And it was like, this ain't gonna work. Like, next.
Yeah, definitely. And sometimes military guys, that's actually a common one that I hear, is like military guys can be excellent trainers because they have such a confidence, but sometimes they can be abrasive to work with for the owners, right? or sometimes I've seen them be a little bit worse for the anxious dogs because they have such an intense confidence that the dog is like, whoa, you are a lot, right?
Right.
You can be a great trainer, but if they're not built for that specific thing, or if they're not the person that you click with well, then probably not the right trainer for you. So those are the biggest things I always say. Definitely looking for, you know, a format of training that'll work for you. I do a lot of virtual training. I do in-person training in my area. But for anxiety, I do a lot of virtual training. That works great for most people. Some people just don't prefer that. So find a format that works well for you. Obviously, if you have an anxious dog, I always recommend contacting me, because I can either, even if we're not the right fit, I can usually direct you in a good direction. Hey, this is maybe who you should talk to next, or this is what you should look into next. I'll always do a free consultation over the phone with people. You know, give me a call and we can talk about your dog, and I can give recommendations, whether it's my own programs or somebody else's, or a direction to go in, or something to ask your vet about. I can usually give you at least some tips and stuff. So I always recommend, if it's anxiety, definitely give me a call. I'm always happy to chat with you about it. And then if we're the right fit, then we'll get you working in our programs and we'll get you on your way and doing fantastic. But yeah, looking for a trainer that you click with is big. Looking for real results is really big.
And so with your program, it's like part video and then part actually working with you one-on-one too, like whether by Zoom or something like that. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. So my program is, there's a number of components to it. You basically get the main program. We have a couple different tiers that are just kind of different price points and depending on like people's experience level. But the main one is you get weekly video lessons that are downloadable. You keep forever. So it's basically all of the reason I did that is because I was like, I'm saying the same things over and over to a million people. I might as well boil this down so it's actually really clear. So I'm saying it the way I like it and the way it makes sense. And then people can download it and keep it forever. And that way, that's the hard thing with private one-to-ones, is that I might tell you everything you need to know, but nobody can retain that much information.
Right.
And so you're going to forget how I said it. You're going to forget what I said. You're going to need reminders. So the great thing about the program is you get downloadable lessons. You keep all the information, you keep forever. And then you get weekly assignments as well. So corresponding to what you're learning, you also get assignments that you're supposed to do. Keep in mind, this course is 6 months long. So you get a lot of information and a lot of assignments. It's really built to take you from the beginning to the end. I don't want to see people walking away from this program having to go finish working on anxiety. I want them to be moving into a new normal as they walk away from this program. That's kind of how I designed it. Everybody's going to be different, but that's the idea behind the program. So you get weekly lessons that are downloadable, weekly assignments. I then review those weekly assignments, make sure you're doing great. You get access to me through text. You can send me videos of what you're doing, making sure that things are going well. I respond to those and make sure I give you lots of tweaks. You know, when I see videos of how you're doing, I can give you tons of tweaks about how to change that, how to do it a little better, how to make sure you're doing it right. You'll also get once a month, you get a video call with me where we go through whatever you're working on. We make sure we tweak it. We do real-time work. We can touch on other behaviors if needed. I have a wide variety of experience. So even if you have like, hey, we also are struggling with this totally unrelated behavior, we can usually touch on that in the one-to-ones. It's not technically part of the program, but we can usually touch on that type of stuff. And then we also have group calls once a month where everybody in the program gets together and we do a group call where I go over whatever I think everybody's kind of generally struggling with or maybe needs some help with. And then we have a Q&A section of that as well. And then you also get access to our group, which is basically just you can post questions, you can post successes. Everybody gets to kind of support each other, rally around each other. I get in there and answer questions and things like that. Sometimes if you have a question that you text me and it's pertinent to the group, I'm going to say, hey, let's actually put this in the group so we can answer it for everybody to see. So it's kind of got that community feel as well. So that's what our program is all about. It's very, very comprehensive. It's got all the information you need. And then you also get that direct. That's why I wanted direct one-to-one. So you have to have that live access to a trainer so they can tweak the things that you're doing. So that's why I really wanted to add that part in there as well.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like that could be really life-changing for somebody who's struggling, you know, like the 6-month period, you know, of going from, you know, I'm really overwhelmed right now to really moving into that new normal. So you are a wealth of information, Alex. Thank you.
And to put it in reference too, you know, usually if I do a board and train, it's like a 3 to 4 week thing. And that's fairly common for board and train. So you think 6 months that's a lot of time to be able to really work through the issues that you're having.
Yeah. So tell us where we can find you.
Absolutely. So my website is alexsdogtrainingprogram.com. You can also text or call me. My phone number, my business number is 603-404-4649, 603-404-4649. And then you can also email me at alex.peacock@alexsdogtraining.com. Get on the website. You can see what we do. You can contact us through there. Those are the best ways to get a hold of us.
All right. Well, I'll make sure we have links to everything for you in the show notes. And we thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
I'm so thankful to Alex for his time and all that he shared with us. I was trying to figure out what I thought my biggest takeaway would be, and there were a lot of great takeaways, but I think the one that stuck with me the most is about remembering that when we have an incident with our dog, that it's not just one action, that it's like 20 different small actions that our dog is experiencing. Now, this might not apply in a situation like there's suddenly fireworks going off that scare your dog, but in these complex human-to-dog interactions or dog-to-dog interactions, there's always a lot more going on from the dog's perspective than maybe we as the humans are realizing. And so I really appreciated that reminder. Now, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but if you like this episode and if you know anybody in your life dealing with an anxious dog, I'd always appreciate if you'd share this episode with them. I was recently joking with a friend that sharing resources is my love language. And while I was making a joke in that exact situation, I realized that it's very, very true about me. And I'm sure all of my friends who are listening know that. If you have a problem and I think that I can help in any way, I will send you tons of links and books and information and podcasts and videos because I want to help solve the problem. If there was a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Sorry, couldn't help myself. Sometimes my brain still operates on lyrics of songs from the 1990s. All right, that'll do it for this episode of the Believe in Dog podcast. If you like this episode, remember that you can always leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It's pretty much the biggest compliment that you can give a podcaster. You can always find me at Believe in Dog Podcast on Facebook or at Erin the Dog Mom on Instagram. So until next time, this is Erin Scott sending you hugs and belly rubs. The Believe in Dog podcast is a production of Hugs and Belly Rubs, LLC.